Hello, everybody. I'm Liz Testa, and this is Lavish Hope. I'm so excited for you to hear this upcoming conversation with our special guest, Lynn Min. Lynn is a licensed mental health counselor, certified life coach, pastor, and a mom of three. 8 years of counseling, decades of working with people in and out of the church, and 9 years of motherhood. She affectionately says that all of her caretaking experience has taught her that mental health and spirituality go hand in hand. Wellness is lived out when we are whole, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically, and relationally. And out of all relationships, the most significant one is the one with all the pieces of our own selves, because that is where our inmost beliefs about God and the world first manifest. Lynn's work with clients has been to create safe and brave spaces where couples, families, and even a few brave men, along with many women, can be radically honest, shed some light into their hearts, and connect with their understanding of the divine to experience the healing and freedom they need. In this conversation, Lynn and I talk about so many rich and hope-filled topics, as well as hard things pertaining to the social injustices in our world right now, and also some of the ways that we are being called to live into hope as people of faith. How can we override some of the feelings of shame that come up? How can we embrace more than push away people and community members? So I can't wait for you to come along and listen in with us and see what God says to you as you listen to our next episode of Lavish Hope. Good afternoon, Lynn Min. Good to be with you, sister.
Good to be with you, Liz.
Thank you so much for joining me here on the podcast, Lavish Hope. Just to sort of locate us, this opportunity for you and I to have this conversation came up when we were in a roundtable discussion a few weeks ago within the context of our denomination, our church, the Reformed Church in America, where a group of us that are working on dismantling racism and our CPAM Council, which is the Council of Pacific Asian American Ministries, got together, and our Commission on Race and Ethnicity and our Commission on Christian Action all came together to just talk about the current climate and the things that are happening in our world, particularly as they pertain to AAPI people and community, and right after the murders in Atlanta. And so, Lynn, when we sat together and talked, and you were sharing from your perspective, both as a young Asian American woman, but also as a very wise therapist engaged with people in the New York City area and probably well beyond. You talked about wanting to be in a setting where there was hope. And that really does touch my heart. And I thought, Lynn, I want you to come and talk to me on Lavish Hope, stories of resilience and overcoming, just so that we could explore that a little bit more together. Like, what does hope look like in this current context, in this current climate? How do we create spaces for hope? But also that ones that are authentic and real and actually are attending to some of the reform, some of the repentance, the things that need to happen for us to come to true racial reconciliation and healing. So welcome into that space.
Yes. Thank you for inviting me into this space. Maybe we can start with the story of how all of this was processed, you know, or I can just invite the listeners onto how I processed all this. So I remember when I first heard about the shootings at Atlanta, I remember how I was feeling numb. I went through with the day like as if nothing happened. You know, I, like the good Asian person I am, I got my stuff done, you know, and then like the responsible person I am, you know, I did what I needed to do. I listened to all my clients. I did my notes and a few days of that. And you know, what has started happening was I started to see on social media all these things about, oh, you know, AAPI, like Stop Asian Hate, or all these people who are angry and sad. And it started to make me feel ashamed. Like, oh, why am I not as bothered? Why am I not angry? Why am I not sad? I read a post that said, oh, since this happened, I've been crying all day. And I was like, I'm not crying. Is something wrong with me? And I know I needed to sit, because what was triggered for me is just feelings of shame. Shame of like, am I not responding to my own people suffering this way? And a little bit of annoyance, like, why are you guys all like, can you stop reacting and just kind of like, give me a moment, my goodness, you know? I think there was a truth behind that, that I really needed to sit. And really the truth behind that was that a lot of people were feeling that way. A lot of people, my Asian clients were saying, Lynn, is it okay that I feel numb? Is it okay that I'm not doing anything? I don't even know what to say. Mm-hmm. And some people were actually really angry, and they actually gave me the words. They said, why are we all of a sudden all up in arms now? Like, where were these people when Black Lives Matter happened?
Yeah.
And all the feelings towards our own people of like, oh, now we're talking about it. You know, like mom, dad, people in older generations, now we want to talk about race, right? Didn't really need to be this to talk about this, but now, you know, all of these feelings all at once, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. And to lead to a place of shame, right? Am I doing this right? And it kind of goes to understanding how Asian people process to begin with, right? We go inward. We sit with stuff a little bit longer. It's a good thing and a bad thing. Like, we don't like to talk about things until we kind of finalize our perspective on it. We don't process externally. It's like a changing room thing, right? We like put on our makeup and then we show up. You know, we present. We have a certain sense of certainty. We only show the final product or the perfected thing, and we're discouraged from changing our minds, right? Because it makes us feel wishy-washy or like flaky. We mean what we say and we say what we mean, that kind of thing. And so that internal period of like going deep and or like just going inward and withdrawing for a second, I think it's so normal. It's something that was embedded in me, you know, don't be rash. Don't, you know, just think through things before you speak, that kind of wisdom, right? Mm-hmm. It's so funny that I caught myself instead of celebrating that and just acknowledging, oh, that's how I'm processing, I went straight to shame. Because what's also true is I'm taught by the American culture of what I should be.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I should be loud. I should be individualized, you know? Juxtapose all of the culture that I have learned observationally and just by growing up to like, don't rock the boat. If you have nothing good to say, don't say it. You know, that's being the better person. Hold it in, be patient, develop a capacity for long suffering, avoid conflict, you know, prioritize the collective unit over the individual, make decisions based on how others might feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's actually a word, there's certain things in my culture, and it's funny because now I'm able to verbalize it after months of just processing just this, you know. There's a word called munchi. It comes from two Chinese characters, and it's a Korean word, but it comes from two Chinese characters. Nun, meaning eye, and qi, like Tai Chi, power. It's this eye power, it's this perception that you have, but it's really signifying the subtle ability to listen and gauge other people's moods.
Interesting.
Right? And so when you don't have this eye power, you're considered kind of like socially dull and like not all there. When you're sharp, when you're charming, you have lots of nunchi, right? And so an Asian person's world, like they see their worlds hugely based on, it's based on their ability not to be self-aware, not to be self-emotive, but with their ability to see and gauge how others are feeling around them, right? And a lot of the things that we were taught naturally come from these good things, like go inward, examine the self first, you know, communal acceptance and belonging, huge, huge, right? It brings honor to our families, and it's how we gauge our own value and worth. We value like a gracefulness and a groundedness, a particular emphasis on things that are unseen and unspoken. Meaning, I remember when I asked my dad, how come you don't say I love you to mom? And he says, why do I have to say that? I work and come home and I give all the money to your mom. She knows I love her, right?
Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Maybe she does, maybe she doesn't, I don't know. But that's interesting, right?
Yeah.
And this weightiness of like we're taught to believe, or like there's something in the culture where like the truth of the way things are will reveal itself. Like the truth is almost cheapened if you have to prove it or say it. Like there's like a sense of ego attached to this. For example, if I'm really pretty, then I don't need makeup or flashy clothes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm trying too hard. Or if I'm really good at what I do, my boss will recognize it and the promotion will come. I think in some weird ways, theologically, it's like if God really loves me, and it's kind of linked to this weird way of like, then he will like, you know, make stuff happen for me in the way that I think is prosperous or blessed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe when it doesn't, and when I have to put words to it, when I have to ask, and when I have to make things happen for me, it doesn't feel good. It must not be true. I must be going against the grain. And so this is, I think, where like passivity comes in, because we're taught the ability to radically accept things the way they are is wisdom and maturity.
Mm-hmm.
And while that's profound, I think it's often expressed as passivity, as we just try to accept, maybe even to a fault, right?
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Like showing honor to others more than ourselves, we often shrink so we can let others shine.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a good person does.
Yeah.
How do we, you know, offer respect? We don't point out other people's wrongs, you know, and if we do, we're probably stepping out of line, or we don't point it out unless we get it right. And so we have this very perfectionistic mentality. We don't want to be a hypocrite, and we respect others by giving them space. We don't take space. We even give our own space. We're taught to consider the good of somebody else over our own. And it's funny because especially if the sacrifice is of our own wellness, it's like it almost adds the extra, wow, you must be a really good person.
Yeah.
Right.
That long suffering you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a sense of sacrificial, right? Yes. Sacrificial living.
Yes. So sacrifice is this huge expression of respect and love, right? So this common immigrant story that I grew up with, oh, my parents sacrificed everything they've known all of their lives to come to America so that their kids can have an opportunity for a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a culture that, you know, maybe it didn't tell me to do that, but I know I was expected to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't stand up for your own wants or needs or space or voice, sacrifice all of that for the sake of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really confusing how all this plays out because,
totally.
You know, I,
with
remember,
Western society being all about like looking out for number one, survival of the fittest, you got to make it on your own. You were talking about the individualistic.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things you're talking about, Lynn, in terms of like your cultural norms, right? That part of it is so super like Anglo-Northern European dominant, like what we call white cultured Western culture values. And then there's these other values that are more around community and family and honor that are much more about the global, like global perspective, people from Latin cultures,
yes.
I think about my Mediterranean culture, people from, you know, from Africa, from the global South. So I see there's this kind of, you know, kind of a strange middle space that you would occupy, that is like part of it is very Western thinking and or aligns well with Western ideals. And then other parts of it, complete conflict.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because sometimes I feel like they're extremes or the opposites, but sometimes they just don't go together. You just need to know where you're at. And, you know, like even my friends will say to me, you know, when you speak Korean, your voice changes. It's higher and it's more flowy and it kind of like invites people to be like, I'm lower than you, you know, like I'm submissive to you. Like I'm this nice, gentle, flowy thing. Or when I speak, you know, and in a sermon, like in English, my voice changes or when I get on the phone, you know, and it's interesting. Like I remember in second grade, I was barely speaking English and my teacher was saying something to me. And so she was teacher. I don't know what she was saying, but I probably looked down and I was afraid. She took my chin and like forced it to her. And she said, hey, you look at me when I talk to you.
Right.
And I just remember being so scared, like just fear. I did something wrong. And then I remember, you know, juxtapose that with like my junior high school experience when my dad is yelling at me and I'm just looking at him to let him know, I hear you. I want to, you know, like, I understand what you're saying. And he like looked at me and he was like, how dare you look me directly in the eye?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so everything that I just talked about, you know, if you kind of juxtapose that with the American culture that we function in today, where we're taught that we should speak up,
mm-hmm.
right? Our feelings, yeah, our viewpoints, opinions, like seek individuation. We should be able to do things for ourselves, by ourselves, you know, and have a clear like sense of this is mine, and there's value to that. And there's almost like this, if you don't know how to do that, then, you know, there's like a little shame to that, you know, and even with boundaries, I didn't understand. I mean, I would be in my own therapist room going like, what does that even look like to set a boundary? My mom says, for example, like really, can I have $100? I need $100 this month, right? And let's say I have it, but I don't want to give it to her because I've given it to her for the 17th time.
Mm-hmm.
What does boundaries even look like? Do I just say no? And that doesn't feel good. Like I didn't know what that would even look like and how that would even fly. And so my therapist is like, what would that look like? I'm like, I have no idea, you know? And I remember in high school, like thinking like, oh, I hate critical essays. I hate it. You know, like, why would anyone teach you how to be critical? You know, a book reports that was like, where do you disagree with the author?
Right.
Nowhere. He's the professional. I'm here to learn, you know,
yeah.
Tell me what to do. I will learn it and soak it up. I am the student. I am only 16. What do I know about what you just wrote a book on? Right. You know, and I never understood that. And so what I'm realizing nowadays, as I start to understand why I'm reacting to, and like why I'm emoting the way I'm emoting, is there's such a sense of shame.
Yeah.
You know, like in this, while we are navigating these two different cultures, I think the question is like, what's wrong with me that I don't know how to do this boundary thing, or I'm not individuated, or, you know, in one set of the culture, it's like, I don't belong here. Like this feels really unhealthy. But then again, like these are the people we love and these are the people we want to honor. And then we come to this other place and we're like, this doesn't always feel good either.
Well, wondering about then, you were mentioning at the when we were first starting to talk, and you were talking about what happened in Atlanta and saying that you were starting to have feelings of shame with that. I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more into that about, you know, and that you had clients that were saying they were numb. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a shock response is very common for people, but it does come from something.
Yes.
But just to talk a little bit more about all that, unpack that if you can.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing me back there, because I think what the shame was is I had this idea that I was supposed to be, like, I've always considered myself a pretty, you know, social justice oriented person,
mm-hmm.
right? And it was much easier almost to react out of anger when it was like a Black Lives Matter movement, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And when it was something different and I saw all these other triggers of like, oh, now my parents are scared. Like, did they not know this was coming? And then it's like, oh, how dare I feel that, you know, like, it's almost like I was kicking my own people while they're down kind of thing, you know? I just felt so much of these contra energetic feelings that I think what I didn't realize was I unconsciously or subconsciously held this understanding of this is how I should be reacting.
Mm-hmm.
I should be going out to protests. I should be writing more about how angry I am. And more, you know, I should be feeling something about the white man, you know, who shot these, you know, and like, and the truth is like, I just wasn't having a lot of that. I needed some time. And I also felt like this was a huge, you know, call internally for my people. I was also asking my people, instead of saying, hey, okay, this is, look at that white man. Oh, it's the white man again. Of course he shoots, you know, the minority. It's like, I didn't want to add to that, you know? I think maybe if I'm really honest and courageous about it, I think what it was is like, what was more urgent for me was a prophetic voice for my own people. Hey, you know, so instead of pitying ourselves, like, this is done unto me. Well, here's some questions I wanted to ask, you know. Yeah, would you have been upset if another Korean man came in and shot eight people? Would we be even publicly crying like this? Or would we be actually burying it under the rug? You know? Wow. And where was this response? When your fellow Black sisters and brothers were crying too, where were you? Where were you, my people? There was a little bit of anger.
Yeah.
And also the caring part of it is, you know, nobody is served when we adopt the self-pity mentality of things are done unto me. Like, there's a rightful place, I think, to acknowledge that kids came home that day and they will never see their mom again. That breaks my heart, you know? Like, I can only imagine, like, they probably never really had moments with their mom where they were tender. Their mom probably weren't moms, you know, that were like, I love you, that weren't vocal. And I still have nightmares about this even now where I'm like, oh, if dad dies, I would never have really hugged him and told him I love him, because that's just not the role that I have with him. Mm-hmm. That's just how Asian families roll, you know? But to that, I wanted to call out also, I mean, are you surprised why we are fetished?
Mm. Yeah, that's a whole second sort of robust piece of this, right? Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, like, I was listening to, like, I was trying to process the story of why, you know, this white male went in there and did what he did, not to excuse it, not to say it's okay. But I was more like, okay, you know, I really believe, you know, that saying, you know, with great power comes great responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe where you pick up, where you see what your part in it was, you pick up great power.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I was desperate to see, how did we let this go so far? How were we so silent? And how were we so fetished, like fetishized? And what's the role that Asians have played in this?
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm really, really honest, I do the same thing with my own parents. I don't understand the humanity of my own people. If I look at my people and my generation, perspective of like the first generation, right? I don't know what they're feeling. I mean, I can imagine, but it's from a distance. You know, they're not really humanized for me. Their roles. My dad had a role. You know, he was a pastor. He was the breadwinner. You know, when we think about the ways that we even identify ourselves, it's like mm-hmm. through an organization, the school that we go to, the church that we attend, the socioeconomic, you know, I'm married, or, you know, I'm rich, I'm poor, or whatever that is, mm-hmm. right? But it's really not in an individual human way of like, this is how I'm feeling. This is what I'm thinking. You know, these are my dreams. We don't do that. We don't do that well. And so it starts from the family, the nuclear family. And I can see why people, you know, kind of objectify us as like the good accountant.
Sure.
Right. Or like the hardworking, you know, whatever, waitress, the helpful waitress.
Mm-hmm. Those stereotypes, right?
Yes. That,
yeah.
Yes.
I'm also thinking about, you know, the model minority.
Mm-hmm.
And when you were talking, just when you were painting that very vivid picture about the cultural norms, right? So much of that sort of being submissive.
Yes.
You know, suffering gladly, all of those people, and then being the best you can be, right? The perfectionism,
yes.
Not emoting, keeping it all together,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That there's rewards for that.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. And so thank you for bringing that up, because that also helped me understand that, you know, the shame, I was shameful of myself because I didn't understand my own story. And I needed to go back and understand why I am the way I am, just in a very deeper way with this whole race thing. Mm. And I remember it's almost like if you don't identify with the victim, then you must be the perpetrator or something like that. And in this weird way, along with this model minority has been this like weird sense that like Asians are just like have white privilege.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Right. We have white privilege because we are model minority and I used to just kind of avoid it because it's such a touchy subject. But honestly, if I were to talk about my feelings, it would be like, I don't know what they're talking about. We work so hard and we live the immigrant life. And I just remember when it was just like brought to my attention, again, the shame. I was talking about race with another therapist who happens to be of African-American descent. And she said, it's so surprising how you're also an immigrant, or minority, but you have a lot of, you talk with a lot of like white privilege.
Wow.
And I shrank. I wanted to withdraw. I was so ashamed. Like, you know, and I kind of wanted to be like, no, please don't, you know, like, I'm not the perpetrator. What are you talking about? That kind of thing. And I found myself wanting to overcompensate and explain. I felt so misunderstood.
Wow.
And then, again, shame.
Sure. Shame. I wonder, did you unpack together at all what kind of white privilege was being talked about? What was she like? What was that looking like? How was that?
I think it was because, you know, there is a part of the story where it's really real that like Asians work so hard. We just put our face, like we like put our heads down. We didn't emote and it came with the cost. Right. And now people look at that and say, that's the model minority privilege that you just worked hard. But like, see, we don't experience it as a privilege.
Right.
Right. That was our way of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did unpack that a little bit and what I was able to come to understand and maybe also like, and it was, there's so much playing out there, of course, you know, like coming from a collective point of view, I wanted to make sure that she was like not feeling attacked or da-da-da. In the meanwhile, I'm feeling attacked. Right.
<Of course.
laughs> Yeah. And so there's so much playing out, but I think now I can kind of own this part of the story too. If we're real, and now I can say to my Asian brothers and sisters, hey, this is the huge wake-up call for us that maybe the privilege is, and we didn't mean to play that out, but nevertheless, it's been playing out. And what it is this, maybe I don't speak for Chinese Americans or other Asian Americans, but for the Korean Americans, I mean, my grandmother would talk about, when there was the war, the kind white men would come and save us.
Mm.
From those darn Japanese people, or, you know, we like turned against each other, you know, those communists and those blah, 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 you know, and the white man saved us.
Wow.
And also when I listened to my dad, there's this like story of like, you know, when I didn't know any better, right? The white missionaries,
mm-hmm.
they came and they brought us the way of salvation.
Yeah.
And they made a way for us to come to, you know, like America. It was their land and, you know, whatever. They found it first. But it's just like, and I studied with these white professors, you know? And so what happens is, yeah, deep in our collective subconscious is this way of like, is this the whiteness? Mm-hmm. Is like our goal,
mm-hmm.
right? It is our salvation. Mm-hmm. It is the bettering of life. They knew the better way. They, you know, pointed us to the way, you know, they pointed us to Jesus. They were like our safety nets. I mean, and then you ask those people, why would you want to be anything different?
Yeah, of course.
You care for a duckling, you know, and they're following you everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so ingrained in us that even our standards of beauty have whitening cream and double eyelids and this prominent nose, you know, that like sticks out, and, you know, even the body shape, you know, like, and so I think what we have to just kind of wake up to for my dear Asian brothers and sisters is that, not meaning to do so, but it was a way of survival. It was like a survival mechanism.
Sure.
And sure. I think,
well, many cultures and peoples, there's the saying, white is right.
Mm.
White is right. And so it's like, it's the ideal. And I think just, you know, a lot of harm has been done to humankind and to, you know, people's psyches, and just, you know, changing the way people, you know, have communal practices, because that way was not desirable through the lens of whiteness.
Right.
So there's a lot of, I think, corporate pain around that. But thank you for illuminating for us the ways that you see it occurring within your own. I think it's really helpful. And also saying, you know, I appreciated you bringing in, talking about the war, because we do know that there's things that happen, right? Sort of moments in time in the social structure of time that are, you know, things happen, and that can also shift the way that people interact with each other, or the way that they think, or what have you. And so just talking about the missionary experience, the war experience, it's important to take those things into consideration. And then as we move through time, we get further away from those, and then the next generations perhaps don't understand why things are a certain way. But for the elders, they're holding on to that for dear life.
Absolutely.
Because that was their survival,
Absolutely.
Their coping. I wanted to just give you the opportunity, if you like, to share your definition of shame. But Brené Brown, who we love, you know, she's one of our lead shame researchers, Dr. Brené Brown, she talks about shame as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging, something we've experienced, done, or failed to do that makes us unworthy of connection. Mm-hmm. And she sometimes juxtapositions that with guilt, which guilt can sometimes have more positive ramifications. It can be used for good. But just wanted to see if you had anything that you wanted to name about shame, just for our listeners that may not be as familiar with the topic.
So, I would say guilt is sometimes like when, I did something wrong. I could have done it better, you know, and now I can realize and I can kind of separate and see the difference between me and my behaviors, right? But shame is when I feel like I am something wrong. It's about identity. It goes deep. And so the problem with shame is that, you know, it creates a space where it's not safe to ask questions. It's not safe to emote. It's not safe to be a human being. Why? Because I'm flawed. I'm not worthy of love or connection, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's also this, like, so that's why when I said, when it caused me to go into shame, I had to sit with it. Like, because I know, right? I can, like, I'm a therapist. Like, I know, like, I'm worthy. Like, so why do I feel this?
Mm.
And when I don't understand why I'm feeling something, it's usually a good sign that I either take it to my therapist or sit with it. Right.
That's
and
good.
I'm realizing, just there's so much of the forgiveness I needed to do, even for my own people, you know?
So good to bring up forgiveness. Thank you, because I think that is, for many of us, that is such a key thing, is to, you know, that's why the Bible says, right? Not just seven times, seven times 70.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ever and ongoing process, but it is important for us to be able to break through some of those chains that are binding us around shame.
Yeah.
And around feeling less than. So they say, right? Forgiveness is not for the person that needs to be forgiven, but for the person doing the forgiving.
Yes. And in that weird, like, way, I felt like maybe this is a huge divine wake-up call. It's one of those moments where our eyes are opened and we can actually see, wow, we've been sleeping for a long time. And wow, now it's really no longer okay to just continue living the way we live because of whatever we have experienced, right? Now it involves everybody. But the truth is, it has always involved everybody, right? The systematic way that hate really plays out has always involved everybody. And I think it's our Asian Americans like turn to really see how it has all played out, the pluses and the minuses. And I think the call, the divine call that I find is, you know, it's so psychologically true that it's almost like, it's like this, like Jesus teaches, you know, love others as you love yourself. It has to start with the self.
Mm-hmm.
And when we don't feel safe, we're not a safe place for others. You know, we can't take people where we haven't been. And if we're vibrating with like an energy of hypervigilance, this flight or fight or freeze mentality, mm-hmm. and we're sensing unsafeness or, you know, some kind of danger or threat, you know, we have to understand that we will never be anything else but that than where we are emoting and being from.
Yeah. Thanks again for listening in to the Lavish Hope podcast with Lynn Min. I hope more than anything, this episode has brought you one step closer to unpacking what lavish hope, resilience, and overcoming means to you in your own life and your own story. You can connect with Lynn and follow along with her upcoming writings and offerings through Facebook at Lynn Min, LynnMin, or consider taking an online course on her website, www.lynnmin.com. That's www.lynnmin.com. If you enjoyed this Lavish Hope podcast, please subscribe, comment, and reshare any place you're on social. This episode is brought to you by faithword.org, an online learning community where you'll find ideas for living out your faith, reflections on scripture, the church, and faith, stories about how other Christians are following God's call, and resources to bring to your own church or organization along for the ride. The Lavish Hope podcast is hosted by me, Liz Testa, produced by Anna Radcliffe, with assistant production by Lorraine Parker, sound design by Garrett Steyer, and web support by Grace Reuter and Barb Ellis.